This is Audible.
Infinite. Written by Jeremy Robinson. Narrated by R.C. Bray. One. Solitude. Go on, she says, chewing on a yellow number two pencil that makes dry scratching sounds whenever it carves a letter onto the equally yellow legal pad resting on her tight gray skirt. I know she's supposed to be evaluating the state of my psychological well-being, but I can't help analyzing her in return. The way her teeth leave divots in the pencil flesh tell me she enjoys hearing people's personal details. Probably too much. Her form-fitting clothing tells me she wants to be noticed, but the power suit warns against saying anything. Because she's married, so says the ring on her finger. But is it her husband she'll be telling my personal details to later on, or the guy she's trying to impress with those tight clothes? Then again, maybe I'm just a sexist pig judging a woman by her clothing. Mr. Chenock? The rebel in me says to screw with her, to lead her down a confusing rabbit hole of contradictions, but that's probably a bad idea. I want to be here. I'm an introvert by nature, so I tend to spend a lot of time alone. Uh-huh. Scratch, scratch, scratch goes the pencil. But that doesn't mean I don't like people. I just feel tired after engaging with them, she says. I know what an introvert is. Right, I say. Of course she knows, but isn't she just supposed to let me talk? My eyes drift toward her crossed legs, which are at head level as I lie back on her tilde-shaped couch. The underside of her exposed hamstring, like a smooth, upside-down sand dune, captivates me. Light glimmers off her bifocals as she looks up from her legal pad. My eyes dart to the side. I pretend to be absorbed in the first thing my gaze lands on, a digital edition of Modern Parenting. There's a baby on the cover lying in a shallow river, worn oval stones all around it. Did she see me? I try to hide my growing discomfort, as I realize the tight skirt might be a test. Scratch, scratch, scratch. I don't know if that pencil has an air bubble in the graphite or a granule of something, but it starts to have a nails-on-chalkboard effect on my teeth. Who uses pencils anymore? Forget the pencil, I tell myself. Is she noting my attention on her legs or on the baby? I can think of a million ways both could count against me. Preoccupation with sex, a desire to have children. Shit, they're even related. Can't have a baby without first having sex, and here I am talking about my fear of solitude. I try to recover. I think it's because I connect so deeply with people, you know? She twists her lips, tapping the chewed pencil against them. Her shade of red lipstick matches her curly hair. A test, I remind myself. All of this is a test. Look away. I don't. She's mesmerizing. When people talk, I listen. I mean, I really listen. I feel their joy, sadness, and pain like it was my own, and I don't do small talk. I don't care about the weather, sports teams, or the latest webisode. I just connect with people. Oh, God, just shut up. I sound like a dating profile. And that's exhausting, she says. Not a question. She's agreeing. Is she talking about me? Is she saying that I'm exhausting? The ceiling calls out to me, beckoning my attention to its frosty white surface where nothing changes. It's empty and peaceful. I find calm in it. For a moment. Scratch, scratch, scratch. You seem nervous, she says, and when I stay lost in the white too long, she uses my name again. Mr. Chenock. William Chenock, I say, doctor of computer science. That's who I am. I know who you are, she says. Just like to remind myself sometimes. Can you forget who you are? I almost did once. Scratch, scratch, scratch. I know 12 languages, and just one of them is spoken. Why did I say that? Am I trying to impress her, or am I reminding myself about that, too? English and 11 programming languages? Close. English, 10 programming languages, and Latin. I laugh. It's forced and uncomfortable. They said it would help me learn other Latin-based languages, French, German, Spanish, you know. Code, not so much.
You're smarter than other people.
I wouldn't say that.
But people do.
I guess.
Is that why you find it so hard to connect with those around you?
Hard. I feel the need to look her in the eyes, but the shadows now sliding across the ceiling hold my attention. I just said,
I know what you said, but the truth is, you haven't spent time with anyone in a long time. How long has it been, William?
Fuck you!
I don't know. How long since you've been with someone?
The words on their own are suggestive enough, but the honey she's dipped them in before opening those red lips is enough to distract me from the ceiling. She looks at me over the top of her gravity-defying glasses, clinging to the tip of her nose. Two blouse buttons have been undone, revealing the top of her curved breasts. Her skirt is shorter. Not hiked up, just shorter. Scratch, scratch, scratch. I close my eyes at the sound.
Would you mind not... The pencil was in her mouth. I saw her lips wrapping around the gnawed yellow surface like two delicious slugs, wet and...
What is that sound? I ask.
What do you hear?
Scratching.
Have you been hearing it this whole time?
The shadows on the ceiling dance with the fervent shifting of trees caught in a storm. I turn toward the window and squint. The distant sun reflects off the atmospheric dome, illuminating the room. But there are no trees.
There are no trees, I say.
True, there are no trees, she agrees, on Mars. I point at the ceiling. Then, what is that? The shadows vibrate back and forth. The ballet has become a war between light and dark. Scratch. The white ceiling is wounded by four long black lines. Scratch, scratch. Long streaks carve away at the white, revealing color, hues of gray and orange, dark red.
You know what this is, she says, just like you know who you are.
William Chenoak. I turn toward my beautiful psychologist, who would have mounted me on the tilde couch after patching the holes in my consciousness.
You're not real.
She points at the ceiling.
That is.
I'm waking up. This is it. She smiles at me.
Try to connect. You don't need to be alone anymore.
The white office fades. There's a hiss and a cloud of steam. A face leans in through the mist, smiling. It's Tom Holden, the secondary computer scientist. I'm the primary. We're friends. We understand each other. But there's something off about his pale face. Something different. It's red, like her lips. Wet, too. At the very moment I realize it's blood and I hear the screams, he plunges a long screwdriver into my chest. I feel my heart shudder around the cold metal, and then stop. This is the first time I die. It's not the last. 2. My second life and death is a brief and confusing affair. My eyes flutter open. I see the yellow handle protruding from my chest and think, who uses screwdrivers anymore? It's as out of place as my imaginary shrink's pencil. Then my heart tries to beat around the metal, now warm from my body heat, and it spasms. My body goes rigid, a turbulent breath fills my lungs, and then I'm dead. Again. I assume it's death. I exist in darkness. It's peaceful. Without pain. And there is light. A small spot at first, but growing larger, pulsing and swirling. I hear a hum, but it's not constant white noise, like I need so I can fall asleep. It's modulating. Is that a voice? Is some long-dead relative coming to guide me into the afterlife that I don't believe exists? Even if that was possible, could a spirit travel the 1,400 light-years from Earth to Cognata, the common name for Kepler-452b, that quickly? It took us 10 years locked in cryosleep to cross the distance. Not quite as fast as the old Star Trek ships, but faster than light, FTL, is still impressive.
It also means that 1,400 years have passed back on Earth, and humanity has either solved the environmental problems that sent us first to Mars and then beyond the solar system, or they've given up and followed us into space. That would be the logical choice. I spin toward the voice. It's the guy from the original Star Trek, with the pointy ears. I grew up watching the Next Generation series with my brother Stephen. My father had inherited copies of every episode from his father and his father before him. My favorite character was always the bald captain, with his French name, subtle British accent, and stalwart dedication to exploring the vast unknown. My brother and I memorized catchphrases from the show, my favorite being tea, Earl Grey, hot, even though Earl Grey tea no longer existed. Stephen preferred engage. Anytime we went someplace new, he'd kick off the trip by pointing forward and saying engage, to which I would say, make it so. As a teenager, I saw two of the classic Star Trek movies. I didn't like them as much as The Next Generation, I think out of loyalty to my brother. But the guy with the pointy ears, that guy made me cry. His death resonated with me. What was his name? Leonard? He turns toward the light. His ears aren't pointy. Did God send the actor who played Leonard to guide me? You're not dead, some part of my flickering consciousness says. A chemically induced hallucination. You're dying. Try not to be an idiot. Idiot, I shout. My eyes open. The mist has cleared. Is this all another fantasy, like my psychologist? Could it be a dream? I do sleep. Not a true cryo sleep, but I do have dreams. They usually don't hurt, though. I see the screwdriver again, this time noticing the name etched into it. Pearson. He's an engineer. I don't think the screwdriver is an actual tool, though. The shiny handle and the etching's quality suggest it's a keepsake, a gift from someone who has now been dead for 1,400 years-ish. This time, when my heart pulsates around the burning metal wedged between my ribs, I react in a way I know I'm not supposed to. But I've died twice already, so what the hell? I grab the handle with two hands, and as my vision fades to black, I yank. My body thrashes. My heart twists and coils inside my chest, a living thing trying to break free. Darkness turns to white-hot pain. Liquid warmth spreads over my chest, reminding me why I shouldn't have withdrawn the screwdriver. I'm bleeding out. My panicking, wounded heart is pumping blood straight out of the quarter-inch-wide hole in my chest. I need help. I try to move, but my body is weak, and the smooth surface of the cryo bed, now slick with blood, feels like a soaked-up tub beneath me. I thrash about, thumping with elbows and knees. I try to call out, but my parched, dry throat manages only a hiss. I want to go back to the fantasy, to my red-headed, bespectacled shrink. 10 years in failed cryosleep was torture, but far better than this rude awakening. A perfect combination of motion, blood lubricant, and the position of my naked body sends me slipping down the angled bed. I thump hard against the lip at the bottom, bouncing up and out and landing hard on the floor. It's smooth and tacky wet with cool blood. Not my still warm blood. Lying on my side, I see a hand, the fingers frozen in rigor, clutching at nothing. Blood is pooled around it, chunky, like fatty stew. Coagulated. I can't see whose hand it is, but the size and hair tell me it's a man. He died long before I did. If I died at all. I'm still breathing. Still thinking. Maybe I just passed out before. Maybe the screwdriver wasn't in my heart, but the metal beside it. Maybe I could still live. Wet footsteps paralyze my body. Someone is coming. I want to cry out for help, but don't. Any sane person would be ranting or running. Or anything but walking with the calm, determined slap of bare feet on a wet floor. It's Tom, I think. Has to be. I freeze my eyes in place, staring at my blood dripping from the cryobed's bottom lip. It stretches out like syrup before losing a drip and recoiling back up to start again. The repetitive drip, drip, drip helps me find a slow rhythm for my breathing.
slow enough to go unnoticed, I hope.
Got away.
The voice is scratchy and arid, but still Tom's.
Left me here.
His bare foot squishes through the blood beside my face, a globule of coagulation squeezing up between his toes. The print left behind is a dark red topographical map of his foot. A breeze kicked up by his passing guides the stench of death into my nostrils. My stomach lurches. There's nothing in it. Hasn't been for 10 years. But that won't stop me from dry heaving. Despite my revulsion, I manage to stay rigid as his feet squeal on the floor, turning around.
I moved. I must have moved. Dead, dead, and dead, Tom says. You can stay with me. Our journey isn't done yet. They left me. Now I'm going to leave them.
The foot returns, facing the opposite direction. Tom is standing over me. Something wet drips from his nakedness. I want to shiver, to run. Instead, I stare, lifeless.
I liked you, Will. We had some good times. But you were one of them. I saw you. Saw all of you. But you were tricked, right? So, you can stay. Until your bones.
He's lost his mind. They told us something like this might happen. It's part of why every one of us has a double, an understudy. 50 crew in all, filling 25 positions. And if Tom is telling the truth, they're all either dead or gone. There's only one place they could have gone. Kepler 452B.
Cognata. We're going to keep going. See what there is to see. You, me, this dead lot, and Cap.
Cap. Short for Capria. She's the primary astrophysicist. She's my friend, and if I'm being honest, the focus of more fantasies than my psychologist, who wasn't nearly as attractive as she's become in my mind's eye. But Capria, her dark skin holds my attention like the night sky, and her smile, it's the stars.
I know you had a thing for her, but here's a secret. So did I. It's why I had to kill you. She's still asleep. For now.
He crouches down over me and I feel his nakedness resting on my hip. He pats my shoulder.
Still warm. Saved you for last, that's why. Well, not quite last. Time for Cap to wake up. I hope she doesn't mind the mess.
I shiver as he walks away, the motion unseen, the slippery squish inaudible, thanks to the tune he's now whistling. I turn my head, watching him go. He hops through an obstacle course of naked bodies and twisted limbs. The occupants of Cryo Chamber 5 are all dead. Almost. Death looms near, and help is clearly not coming. The others are either dead or gone, and if they really did flee to the surface of Cognata without supplies or advanced testing or food, they'll be dead soon enough. Cognata might be an Earth-like planet, snugly located in the sun-like Kepler 452's habitable zone. It has an atmosphere, water, soil, acceptable temperatures, and a gravity twice as powerful than we're designed for. But no one really knows what we'll find, or if we can survive on the surface. Our voyage to the planet is what people used to call a Hail Mary. I don't know the source of the term, but I know it means the odds are against us. I try to move, for Cap, but I only manage to slip onto my back. The ceiling is pale white, like the imaginary psychologist's office, but it's pocked with evenly spaced orb lighting, casting a pleasant, sun-like glow. It's supposed to feel like sunrise, greeting us to our new lives in the far reaches of the Milky Way, but I just feel mocked. Our mission was about saving lives, saving humanity. Instead, we've already returned to our basest form. We were born out of primal violence and were destined to be ended by it. Cap deserves better. But maybe she'll choose to live. With Tom, my friend turned mass murderer. I don't blame him. Clearly his mind is gone, but for our mission to end like this? I take a deep breath,
and let it out. It doesn't hurt. At all. I lean my head over and look down. The blood has stopped pumping from my chest. But is that because I'm no longer bleeding or just out of blood? Are these my last thoughts before I die for good, or... I wipe my hands through the blood covering my chest. It's sticky, like nearly dry paint, but it wipes away. I'm expecting excruciating pain when my fingers slide over the wound, but I feel nothing beyond a slight tickle. I wipe again and again, clearing the puncture site. There's no hole. The screwdriver still lies beside me covered in my gore, but the hole it made is gone. It's healed. The first real act of my third life is clutching the screwdriver. Then I spring to my feet, slip on blood, and plummet onto the corpse of Mike Burgess, a botanist who would have tried to grow earth crops on Cognata. I apologize to the corpse and crawl over him and the slick bodies lying beside him until I reach the hallway, which looks like a modern art painting of red streaks on a white canvas. If I didn't know the paint was blood, I might ponder its meaning. Instead, I pull myself up against the wall and add a new streak, sliding my way toward Cryo Chamber 2, Cap, and Tom. 3. The Galahad, so named for the nobility of its quest to find a new home for humanity, is perhaps the most perfect creation mankind has ever conjured. It can achieve FTL travel without killing everyone on board. It can detect and repair malfunctions autonomously. It contains every written word, audio recording, video, and virtual experience ever created, from a digital scan of the Gutenberg Bible to the holoporn raunchy ranch extravagasm. The entire biomass of Earth is contained in a cryogenic laboratory the size of a skyscraper, ready to be bred, planted, grown, and set loose on a new Earth. From seeds to genes to eggs and sperm, Galahad has everything we will need to start anew and pave the way for the colonists destined to follow. For all I know, some are already en route. Unfortunately for them, the Galahad's crew is not nearly as infallible as the ship. I don't yet know how many survived and escaped to Cognata's surface, but the amount of blood decorating the walls didn't just come from one victim. The cryochamber entryways I pass are open, each one filled with a collection of gore. I don't bother to stop and count the dead. It's all just red smudges in my periphery. My eyes remain fixed and focused on the white, curving hallway ahead. Cryo Chamber 2 is just ahead. A whistled tune tickles my ears. I can't identify the song. I'm not even sure it is a song. Just random notes reflecting the chaos that is now Tom Holden's mind. We all knew some form of madness could result from cryosleep. It happens sometimes, especially over long periods of time. But we were tested, vigorously, for years. And this kind of murderous insanity, to my knowledge, has never been documented. One of the first candidates to be weeded out was left in a vegetative state after just a week in cryosleep. 10 years turned Tom into a psychopath. If he was awake the whole time, like me, it could make sense. Then again, I'm not trying to kill anyone. Madness crept up on me from time to time, but never latched on. I suppose some minds are more flexible than others. I really don't know. The human computer has never been my specialty. One sheep, two sheep, never sleep, sheep. The sing-song slows my approach. The slap of my sticky bare feet becomes a whisper. My lungs seize, holding the perfectly blended algae-generated O2-infused air. I peek around the entryway. There are 5 bodies on the floor in various states of disrepair. The most complete of them appears to have been strangled. Deep purple rings her throat. The worst of them has been dismembered, the work of a crude butcher with blunt instruments. How did he have the time for this? He must have woken up first, but he should have been. Shit. Tom and I performed the final system check together. Cryo chambers fell under his purview. He must have adjusted the wake-up sequence in advance. I don't think he was crazy then, and probably just wanted bragging rights. The first to wake. The first to see Cognata. He couldn't have known waking first would have resulted in slaughter. Unless he did. Could he have been mad before we left? but the army of psychologists have been fooled. I've heard sociopaths can be charming. Still, it doesn't seem possible. But here I am, spying on Tom Holden, the man about to kill, or worse, a woman I care about more than I'm allowed to. Our crew of 25 men and 25 women were paired up by teams of geneticists and reproductive specialists. Upon successfully reaching the planet's surface and establishing a viable colony, our genetic partners would be revealed. Loveless relationships blessed by the sacred institution of genetics would help humanity flourish in its new home. The odds of Capria being my partner were 1 in 25. Not impossible, but not great. That's why detachment was so important, to stave off distraction and jealousy, which could poison a tight-knit community. I'm not jealous now. I'm enraged. But there is barely enough blood pumping through my veins to keep me upright, let alone to propel me to violence. I haven't been in a fight since second grade, though I suppose the circumstances are similar. I fought, and won, for the honor of Renee, something or other. I have to at least try for Capria.
I am going to enjoy you, Tom says. We're going to see the universe together. Forever and ever. Happily ever after.
Tom's words trigger my senses. There's a vibration beneath my feet. It's subtle, but it's there. And I know exactly what it means. We're moving. Fast. I'm not sure how long it's been since the Galahad stopped at Cognata, but I do know we're no longer there. Tom is one of a handful of people with the know-how to reprogram the ship's course. How long has he been awake? When Tom leans down to the control screen mounted to the side of Capria's cryobed, I decide to make my move. I'm not a fighter, but if I've learned anything from Tom, a screwdriver can kill a man. Except for me, apparently. I don't make it a single step before announcing my presence. The sound of my sticky foot peeling away from the floor is how I've always imagined the crisp shh of tearing paper would sound. I've never used a piece of paper, let alone torn one, but it rings true in my imagination. Tom shouts in surprise, flailing away from Capria's cryobed like he's been shocked. He looks to the ceiling first, like there might be something up there, and my brain says rush him, while my body tries to stay upright. I don't rush him. I stand still like a gazelle clutched in a lion's jaws, when such creatures still lived. When he sees me, Tom staggers back again. He wiggles his fingers at me, casting a spell.
You're dead. Screwdriver in the chest. Like Mike. Like the others. Well, not all of them, but enough. Sharing blood like that. Not sanitary. It's not really a concern for the dead, which you are. And aren't. I think.
His eyes are wide, unblinking, like an insect. A very surprised and confused insect. I step into the cryo chamber, screwdriver tucked up behind my right hand and forearm. You're hurt, I say, pointing at Tom's chest. He's clothed in blood and stark naked at the same time. Despite that, the claw marks crisscrossing his chest, swollen on the sides, stand out. Someone put up a fight, and I hope the memory of it, or the fact that he's hurt and no doubt in pain, will distract him.
Just an ouchie, he says. You got much worse.
He waggles a finger at my chest.
Not even a hole. You were dead. I stood over you. Gave you a gamer's goodbye.
I try not to show my revulsion. When Tom crouched over me, letting his manhood rest on my hip, he was sending me off to the land of the dead in true video game fashion, the classic teabag. I had thought it was an accident. While I'm not technically a gamer like Tom, we did play together on occasion. When I think back to those matches now, played off-site and off the record, I feel like I've seen murderous Tom before, slaying his enemies, backstabbing teammates, and insulting the dead and dying. It was all good fun in the virtual world. In real life, it's sick. I am dead, I say. He inhales like his mouth has become a vacuum.
A zombie?
While the widespread popularity of the undead faded hundreds of years ago, they remain popular with Hollow Game players, spanning the test of time like other fictional monsters, Dracula, Nemesis, werewolves. A ghost, I say.
You are dead,
he tries to snap, but his fingers are too slippery with blood.
I knew it.
I needed to tell you something, I say, stepping closer, lowering my voice.
Do tell.
I take another step. Paper tears. Tom squints.
Sticky for a ghost.
I don't make the rules. Step. Tear. Step. Tom purses his lips and taps agitated fingers against his thin hips.
You're not dead.
You killed me. Step. Tear. Step. You were there.
I did, and I was.
But now I'm here, and so are you. There was a hole in your chest, and now there is not. Ghosts don't keep injuries. Step. Tear. Step. I'm just a few feet away now, but Tom looks ready to run or attack. I can't tell which. His face is turbulent, caught in the middle of opposing storms.
But the blood!
Tom flicks both hands at me like he is revealing the latest model android. Gore flings from his fingertips and slaps against my chest where it clings.
The blood! It sticks!
I turn my final step into a lunge. The screwdriver comes up in my hand and then drives down in an arc. Our bodies collide with a slippery thumping of knobby limbs, scrabbling fingers, and screaming voices. This is how computer scientists fight. As we descend to the ground, putting on a pitiful display for dominance that makes me wonder how Tom could have actually killed most of the crew, I'm almost glad no one is around to see it. Though Tom and I collide with the smooth, hard floor with roughly the same speed and force, he recovers faster. Perhaps I'm the greater nerd or his mania shields him from pain. I'm not sure which, and at the moment it doesn't matter. His fingers wrap around my throat and squeeze, constricting both my airway and the limited flow of blood supplying my brain with oxygen and consciousness. I bring my fists up against him, noting first the lack of a screwdriver and then the lack of focus. My nails dig fresh troughs in his skin. I slap and punch and kick. None of it matters. There's a ballet of dancing lights, like stars twirling to the music in Tom's head. Then the curtain falls. And I die. Again. 4. Weight presses me, constant and unmoving. It's like a blanket. A pile of them, really. I'm compelled toward sleep once more, mind drifting back into a comfortable dark bliss. I turn over and curl a handful of fabric beneath my chin, just so. But the twist of my body upsets the balanced covering. It slides off my body and thumps onto the bed. Beds don't thump. The thought rings true, but my barely conscious self doesn't care. I'm exhausted. I reach out for the blankets and find them, cold and wet. My nose wrinkles in disgust. What happened to my blankets? I wipe my now moist hand against my hip and find it barren of clothing. When I was a child, I would wake up in the morning stark naked, pajamas piled next to me. I never had any memory of how or why I stripped down. It just happened. That's not what happened this time, I think. I went to bed naked. All this thinking tickles my consciousness to the forefront. It's early morning bright, Mars bright, where there are no trees and no atmosphere to dull the more distant sun. And the bed, it's torturing my left elbow, ribs, and hip, the bones grinding against a cushionless surface. This isn't a bed. I squint against the bright light from above and then open my eyes wide when I find myself caught in a staring contest with Tom. Since corpses can't blink, I lose. Quickly. His dead eyes snap me from the last tendrils of sleep, but as my memory returns in full, I find myself unable to move. Fear holds me in place, pinning my neck to the floor with the promise of fresh horrors to follow, but nothing happens. Tom's dead eyes just keep staring. I shift my eyes, and I'm relieved when his don't follow. Definitely dead, but how?
My neck throbs with pain as I push off the floor to my hands and knees. The grunt of pain rising from my throat comes out as a hiss and a pop. I feel my throat, probing the skin with my fingers. Pain bursts with each touch, but it's not nearly as bad as the strange way my neck is compressed. As fear wells anew, my neck pops out, reverting back to its original shape, and my scream finds its voice. The pain starts to subside too, enough for me to focus on Tom. He lies next to me, candy-coated in blood, mine, his, and everyone else's. A familiar yellow handle rises from his back between shoulder blade and spine. Following the Phillips head's path through his body, I find the tip poking out of his chest. I stabbed him when we collided. Adrenaline and mania carried him through the pain and gave him the strength to strangle me, but madness wasn't enough to deny physical death. But something is, I think. Something has kept me from dying several times over in the short duration I've been out of cryosleep. Thank God Tom lacks the same ability. Or does he? Each time I've died and come back, I've lost all sense of time. I could have been lying on the floor for seconds, minutes, or hours. Death provides freedom from the fourth dimension, but there was no white light this time, and Leonard wasn't there to greet me. If Tom can come back, how long do I have? Fear of being killed again, and again, gets me moving. Lines of pain follow the contours of my body as my blood-glued skin stretches and peels from the cool floor. A warmth tingles from my head to my feet, blood shifting about. I see little lights, a moment of darkness, and then my body's reset is complete. Capria, I whisper, and I stagger to her cryo bed. I place my hand on the frigid glass window while starting a rapid diagnostic on the bed and on Capria. The results are nearly instant and green across the board. I lift my hand from the glass. Beads of moisture have formed where my body heat warmed the surface, allowing me to see Capria's face. Her eyes are closed, at peace, oblivious to the fact that her crew is dead or gone. I envy her. And then I remember Tom. I bend down, clutch his skinny wrists in my arms, and pull. He's heavier than he looks. Or maybe I'm just weak from blood loss and repetitious death. Either way, the effort it takes to drag the man is agonizing. I hate you for this, I tell the corpse as I step into the hallway. How hard did we work for this? I gave 10 years, 10 fucking years, training, eating that shit they fed us, getting poked with needles. I hated every second of it, but I did it because I loved the idea of what we were doing so much. Tom's foot snags on the door, unwilling to bend. I yank him hard, venting my frustrations. He doesn't budge. You? Pull. Are a pull. Fucking pull. Asshole! I twist his body as I heave back again. His foot cracks, and we spill free. My heels thump against the floor as I stumble back, still clinging to Tom. His weight and my tacky feet keep me upright, and for a brief moment of chaos, we make good progress. Then it's step, drag, step again. I hope you do come back. I hope you wake up the moment I open the airlock and launch you into space. They're the harshest words I've ever spoken, but I mean them. He not only slaughtered the crew and doomed those who escaped his lunacy, but there's a good chance humanity itself will face extinction because of his actions. The planet is failing, catastrophically. Food is scarce. The environment is revolting. Billions died from war, starvation, and disease. Cancer, once cured, returned with an aggressive vengeance. We called it neo-cancer. The human race is dying. Was dying. 1,400 Earth years have passed. The Earth and Mars still orbit the sun, but the only people they carry are on their way to becoming fossils. 123 years was the timetable most models projected. 123 years until extinction. Not just of humanity, but of most mammals on the planet. Life on Earth would persist, probably still does, but only in its smallest, most resilient forms. Mars provided a temporary reprieve for a few 100,000, but colony life was not without its dangers, and the domes weren't designed to last forever. The colonies on Mars would have lived long enough to mourn mankind's extinction on Earth, but they would have followed soon after. I'd like to believe they found a way to pull through, but I'm a realist. While many people were still dedicated to solving the problems at home, most agreed that humanity's survival would lie elsewhere in the galaxy, specifically at Cognata. But now, without the groundwork tasked to the Galahad and its crew, humanity's future is as uncertain as my ability to carry Tom to the airlock and send him spiraling into space while traveling faster than light. Will I even be able to open the airlock?
Hey!
The loud voice triggers a physical reaction. I kick Tom hard twice, driving my heel into his spine, hoping to return him to the temporary afterlife, or at least paralyze him. But he doesn't flail or fight back.
What the fuck are you doing?
My eyes flick up. A naked man, his skin clean and tan, barrels down the hall, fists clenched.
Jose, thank God, I say.
Jose Hernandez is a funny guy. He's also our second in command. He'll know how to turn us around and get our floundering mission back on track. Plus, he can help me carry Tom to the airlock. I smile at him and say, grab his ankles, will you?
You fucking psycho!
Jose shouts, lowering his shoulders and gaining speed. Jose, it's okay, I tell him. Tom is dead. You don't need to... With 2 seconds to go before impact, my addled brain understands. Jose isn't looking at Tom, he's looking at me, the man covered in blood, dragging a corpse with a screwdriver in his back. In his mind, I'm the mass murderer of the crew.
Jose, wait!
The impact lifts me off my feet. Jose screams as the three of us descend, a naked corpse sandwich of flailing limbs and emotions. My head strikes the floor. Something cracks. I expect consciousness to fade, or my life to end, again, this time at the hands of my commander, but I'm not dead or even unconscious. Pain echoes through my head, but that's the worst of it. And Jose doesn't appear over me. I roll to my side, my vision scrolling up one white wall, across the morning-lit ceiling and down the far wall, which hasn't been marred by blood. Jose lies atop Tom. They look like lovers, enjoying a silent snuggle, except for the blood, the dry on Tom, the wet dribbling from Jose's mouth.
What did you do to us?
Jose asks, his voice a gurgle. It was Tom, I tell him, crawling closer, flinching as each movement sends fresh pain through my probably fractured skull. Tom killed everyone.
Liar!
Jose shouts with enough force to spray my face with flecks of warm blood, and then more softly.
Fucking liar.
He goes limp, eyes looking beyond me. What happened? I grip Jose's shoulders with shaking hands and pull. He comes away, but I feel like I'm fighting a ghost, pulling the body toward the floor. Then he comes free and rolls onto his back. Blood oozes from a hole in his chest.
Oh. Oh, no.
Driven by the combined force of two grown men falling to an unforgiving floor, the screwdriver was driven up through Tom's body and into Jose's chest.
Why didn't you stop? I ask Jose. We could have figured this out. We could have.
My voice falters when I back into the wall. A warm tear rolls down my cheek and taps against the white floor. I look down at the drop, red with blood peeled from my skin. A second falls beside it. No longer caring if Tom returns to kill me 1,000 times, I hiccup a moan, and then sob, beating my fists against the walls and venting more pain and sorrow than I've endured in my entire life until this point. Not just because my crew and all of humanity is doomed, but because I know my own personal hell is just beginning. 5. Tom's lifeless eyes stare at the ceiling. They don't blink. His life and killing spree are over. And through some sort of twisted freak misunderstanding, he managed to take one last victim to the grave beside him. Jose, like Tom, is permadead. The Grim Reaper's grip on them doesn't falter, while I seem to slip through his skeletal fingers like a well-oiled pig. I'm not sure how long I've been sitting on the floor staring at the bodies, lost in a strange kind of shock.
I've been existing in my own thoughts for the past 10 years, conjuring fantasies while awake and dreaming while asleep, and sometimes not knowing one from the other. In all that time, I've gone to some very dark places, some of which felt very real. But I don't think this is in my head, because I can smell the dead, can taste their blood in the air, stinging my dried-out tongue. And it's not just Tom and Jose. It's all the others, too, settling into the first stages of decomposition. They're going to really start stinking soon, become bloated, seep gas from a variety of orifices. Luckily, our bladders and bowels were emptied before cryosleep, so the mess is limited to the dead and their blood. I'll leave the blood to the drones, but the bodies.
I hate you, I tell Tom. Someday, I'm going to shoot you out the airlock.
I picture Tom's body pinwheeling into open space. Forever. Alone. Like me. I choke on a sob. It's a horrible fate, even for a corpse. I don't hate you. Not really. It's not your fault. Going crazy isn't really a choice. I push myself off the floor, hissing through my teeth as the dried blood peels skin cells and hair from my ass. Back on my feet, I shake off the feeling of hopelessness inspired by the carnage all around me. I don't yet know the full extent of my situation. The Galahad is moving, but I don't know where to or how fast. Turning around might be simpler than I think. And I'm not entirely alone. I have Capria. She's still asleep, and I have no intention of waking her to this mess, but she's alive. While I would love nothing more than to have a companion right now, a second mind to sort through this shit, there's a chance she might make the same assumption as Jose, and the chivalrous part of me wants to protect her from the pain of seeing her friends and crew torn apart. She'll need to be told the truth eventually, but being told, or even shown the ship's video log, will hurt less than a single breath of this dirty, penny-scented air. I stand there, naked and chilled, wondering what to do. I'm good at following orders. I like taking direction, excel at it. Like a guided missile, I just need to be aimed. But I'm on my own. Spreadsheet this mess, I think at myself, and cringe. It doesn't seem an entirely human choice to make. But then I spend a lot of my time with non-living and non-human artificial intelligences of my own creation, including those piloting the drones that will scour the walls, floors, and ceilings clean. There are several tasks that need doing in the next few hours. I need to eat and drink. It's been 10 years, so if I want to live, I need to... My planning hits a wall of sludge and slows to a crawl. I can't die, I tell the corpses at my feet. Tom probably figured out as much before he was killed, but boredom isn't a problem for him anymore. So, let's tack that lower down on the list, if only to see if I feel the effects of dehydration. I unpin the non-existent note and repin it lower on the imaginary list. Why can't I die? I ask Jose. Did you know? Did anyone? I look to my right down the curved hallway lined by cryo chambers. Capria's down there. I could bounce these questions off her if she was awake, but she wouldn't know either. The answers are on the Galahad, hidden somewhere within the culmination of all human knowledge backed up, compressed, and encrypted 100 different ways on a massive variety of media to ensure its safe passage. I helped put it there. I can retrieve it. But it will take time. Probably a lot of time. I unpin the new imaginary note with a pop, and repin it below food and water. While I'm curious about my strange new physical state, the why and how of it can wait until bigger problems are solved, like where I'm headed and how I can turn around. The AI guiding Galahad, known as Gal for short, will avoid any obstacles along the way, so there is no danger of flying through an asteroid field or a star, but the longer we move forward, the longer it will take to get back, if I can figure that out. Gal is smart. Tom made sure of it. But she's also programmed to only obey ranking. My head lolls back, mouth agape. Tom handled Gal's final encoding. If we're moving on a course he set,
He either left himself a back door or added himself to the command hierarchy. Another pin goes in the checklist. They're all big problems that require solutions, and solving them sounds almost like fun. I'm comfortable sitting at a screen or in VR and manipulating code. Dead bodies, not so much. But the decent human being in me says that the dead crew is priority number one. If I was on Earth, I might feel compelled to bury each and every one of them. I'd probably manage a proper grave for the first one in the ground, but the rest would likely lie shallow. They're dead. Empty shells of the people they once were. And I'm not the pinnacle of human conditioning. But, in space, I see an image of my bloating crew members spiraling out into space as I open the airlock. My mind adds a soundtrack, Stars and Stripes Forever. I remember seeing fireworks on the 4th of July. A marching band played the song while lights lit up the sky. That was the last American Independence Day anyone celebrated, because celebrating it required an America. But the bombastic music fits the mental image perfectly. First the explosion, and then the mass of twirling limbs. I smile, and even though I know it's wrong, it sticks. The song twiddles from my pinched lips as I head down the hall, stopping in front of each open cryo chamber counting bodies. The tune peters out when I reach the last open door and speak the number aloud. 36. Plus me and Capria. 12 people made it off Galahad. 12 people without supplies, or food, or advanced knowledge of what they were dropping into. They could all be dead already. From deadly air, from wounds inflicted by Tom, from exposure, starvation, or even alien predators. The darkest parts of my imagination spin to life, twisting downward. What if no one followed us to Cognata? What if things on Earth fell apart and the Mars colonies never built another FTL ship? It's been 1,400 years. What if Capria and I are all that's left? I start whistling again. Avoidance is the best medicine for questions that have no answers. Tom was whistling too, I remember. Am I going mad? I know I'm not. I wish I was. Then I wouldn't have to do what comes next. It takes 8 hours to drag the dead and their severed parts back to their respective cryo beds. In that time, I don't eat or drink, and Stars and Stripes Forever becomes a whisper on my parched lips. But I don't grow any more weary than I was at the start, and I don't pass out from hunger or low blood sugar, both of which should be striking me down. Tom goes last. His heels carve two clean paths through the blood-coated floor as I drag him by his wrists. The dried blood chips away from the ultra-smooth white surface. Compared to my heavy lifting, the cleaning drones are going to have an easy time. Not only will the blood come up easily, but they also don't feel and don't care about where the blood came from. They'll just see red where there should be white, and they'll take care of it. Tom flops down into the cryo bed. His stiff body bubbles to the side and nearly rolls right out of the bed. I catch him under his arms and guide him back, an invalid in my grip. Stiff joints grind and pop as I push him flat. His back thumps, and I realize I've left the screwdriver in him. No way, I tell him. I'm done. With you. I point at the cryo beds in the room, 4 of them holding dead bodies. With all of you. I step back and activate the bed. Like the others, Tom will be perfectly preserved until sometime at a much further date when I can get them someplace with soil. As the machine whirs to life, hissing protective gases around the corpse, the hatch descends. And then stops. With just an inch to go, a warning light flashes. The screen beside the device blinks the word obstruction. I close my eyes. A manic anger wells. I breathe through it, and then bend at the waist. It's the goddamn screwdriver jutting up just a little too far. I could try forcing the hatch shut, but there's a chance it would punch through the glass and I'd have to drag Tom to another cryobed. Clenching my fists, I gently tap the digital open button and wait for the hatch to rise. When I look down at Tom's face, the anger, the rage, breaks free. Yeah! The dull thudding slap of my fist striking meat plays like a metronome for a full 4 count. Then I grip the screwdriver shank and pull. Dead meat slurps, ribs crack, skin tears. It takes 3 hard yanks, but the screwdriver comes free. With a scream, I hurl the tool through the open door. It slams against the far wall, stained dark brown, and clatters to the floor, ending my bout with madness. The first round goes to sorrow and despair. Breathing hard, I reach out and gently tap the close button. The hatch lowers, hisses as the seal sets, and then goes quiet. In the seconds following Tom's entombing, silence creeps over me like a specter. It speaks to me, delivering the haunting message, "You are alone."
6. Hot lashes rip at my back, scouring blood from skin, and part of me wishes it would cut deeper still. The water collecting around the drain swirls with tiny chips of brown blood shifting back to red, like rotten fruit punch. Despite fruit being a rare luxury on Earth and non-existent on Mars, we still had fruit punch. There was, after all, no fruit in it, but there were synthetic vitamins, minerals, and a chemical concoction meant to simulate a blend of fruits, grapes, pineapple, strawberry, and cherry, if the packaging was to be believed. I had a strawberry one. It was tart, not quite ripe, but it still tasted a hell of a lot better than the fruit punch. Less red than the blood washing down the drain, where it will be filtered and recycled for a later shower. When the water doesn't clean the blood out from every wrinkle and crevice, I use a brush, shushing its stiff bristles against my skin, burning it pink. Designed to clean away stubborn grease, the micro bristles make short work of the blood, and my top layer of skin. But I don't mind the pain. I welcome it. It helps stave off the survivor's guilt, rising from the depths like a great white shark, jaws agape, teeth bared, nictitating lenses raised. It will eat me whole if I give in. When I can't see any more blood in the water, I scrub for 10 more minutes. This shower, upon waking, should have been done in 2 minutes flat, cleaning the cryochems from my skin and helping me wake up. But the system was prepared to handle 50 people, not one. So there's time to spare. I wince and look at my arm. The brush tore through my skin. Fresh blood beads and is whisked away to the drain. I watch the long red line seal back up, like new. I lift both arms and inspect them. Despite having rubbed both raw, they look smooth-skinned and devoid of irritation.
What did they do to me?
Water tickles my lips, tempting me to drink, but I'm afraid of getting blood in my mouth. Water off. The stinging spray of too hot water snaps off. The drain at my feet seals shut as a round vent opens in the ceiling. A vortex of warm air swirls around me, evaporating the water coating the cylindrical walls and my body. The moisture is whisked away into the ceiling. If I still had the long brown hair of my youth, I'd look like one of those weird troll dolls I saw in a pop culture history digiguide. I rub a hand over my now-shaven head, letting the millimeter-tall bristles tickle my hand. When the only liquid remaining in the shower stall is hidden within the confines of my body, the door unlatches and slides open. The large sanitation room beyond the door has 25 shower stalls on one wall and 25 toilets on the opposite wall, each with a man's name above it. In addition to cleansing the crew's bodies, both inside and out, sensors in the drains analyze waste, allowing the automated systems to track our individual well-being and adjust our diets accordingly. Since I'm still running on empty, I forego a visit to the all-knowing toilet and head for my locker instead. Inside is a single loose-fitting flight suit. It's slate gray and very soft, with built-in footsoles, like what kids wear to bed. They're loose-fitting to avoid looking sexy, and they lack any kind of insignia, rank, or name tag. One crew with one mission, one mind, and now only one member. I slip into the smooth fabric. Its softness comforts me. A slim magnetic seal up the front snaps together. Tomorrow, if I return to my locker, I'll find a fresh garment, supplied by Gal. But I don't think I'll change anytime soon. After all, there's no one left to impress. Maybe I'll put on someone else's too-tight flight suit and look sexy all by myself. I start to imagine Capria in her flight suit. As loose as it wasn't loose enough to hide all her curves. I see her for just a moment before my insides churn at the memory. It hurts more than it helps. What now? I'm clean and dressed. The drones are working their way through the Galahad, seeking out stress points, damage, and messes. The next time I return to the cryo chambers, they'll look like new. I lick my lips. Feels like I'm running my tongue across stone. The mess deck requires no chef or galley. The AI handles it all, delivering the perfect amount of artificially flavored nutrient slurry based on prior bowel movements. It's a 2-minute walk down gleaming white hallways and 10 seconds in the lift to get from the bathroom to the mess deck, which is located above the cryo chambers, bathrooms, and 2 floors of crew quarters. Above the mess is the gym, a place I only visit when my schedule calls for it, 3 days a week for 90 minutes. William Chenok, I say, standing before the food dispensary. Blood sample required. Gal has a homogeneous voice, neither masculine nor feminine. A small slot, fringed by green light and large enough for a single finger, opens. Without a recent fecal sample, Gal wants my blood. I place my finger in the hole. Back home, the act would often elicit crude sexual jokes from new recruits, most of whom were never seen again. No quicker way to get kicked out of the program than to have sex on the brain. Truth was, we all had sex on the brain. Some of us just hid it better. A cool breeze runs over my finger, and for a moment I can't feel it. Then the light turns red, and I withdraw my finger, the numbing agent already starting to wear off. I turn my hand over, ready to suck away the bead of blood from where I was pricked, but the puncture sealed too quickly for any to escape. Unseen parts whir and hiss. A tray slides into place behind a glass divider. A cup, bowl, and spoon lower onto it. 2 more cups follow. Then, 2 nozzles descend.